Support comes from Bellingham's Whatcom Museum with its historic Hall of Birds on May 31st and June 1st, hosting bird taxidermist and museum preservationist Alice Markham for a weekend of events and workshops. Details and tickets at whatcommuseum.org.
Welcome to Friday and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Does Week in Review give you enough diversity of viewpoint? How about KUOW and NPR? We'll gather a like-minded panel to scold you and tell you what to think. I'm kidding. We're going to discuss from diverging vantage points. Joining me today, my panel, political and public affairs consultant in Seattle and one-third of the Seattle Nice podcast about city politics. Welcome back, Sandeep Kaushik.
Thank you for having me.
Good to see you. INSA Business Insider, investigations correspondent, Catherine Long. Thanks for coming back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And GeekWire, contributing editor, last week's host, this week's panelist, Mike Lewis. Thank you.
Glad to be here, Bill, as always.
Good to have you. Or 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago. By the way, how long ago did we book you all on today's show? It's weeks in advance, generally, isn't it?
Weeks in advance.
So we can plan.
Say, yeah, 8 weeks, 7 weeks.
Right. So we don't know. We don't know what's going to come up. We don't know what you're going to be discussing down the road. So last week there was a report that some Seattle city planners wanted to densify faster than the mayor does, and we discussed it on our show. And it turned out all three of our panelists were basically pro density. They all agreed. Boy, did that annoy some of our listeners, like Joe, who writes, "Your panel was clearly in favor of unrestrained growth and the single-family neighborhood, clearly the bad guy in the growth debate. What was not discussed was that the wealthy developers will wipe out as many trees as they possibly can so that they can build tall, small, expensive townhouses that really only appeal to singles and childless couples. They certainly aren't built with the elderly, the disabled, or with families in mind. So it appears that your panel is in favor of a treeless Seattle with block after block after block after block after block of tall, expensive townhouses occupied by singles and childless couples. Oh, but one of your panelists has a rose garden at his apartment, so all's well. What a sad future for the city that is," says Joe. So now we have a whole fresh panel, and I thought
a replacement panel.
Frankly, yeah, we fired it.
That panel is done with. Whole new set of opinions now.
I don't know what your opinions are, but what do you think listeners should know about this very important ongoing debate? Any reaction to Joe's take about unrestrained growth and making the single family the bad guy?
Yeah, I think Joe gets a few things right. I think Joe really recognizes that market development in Seattle is not necessarily serving everybody equally. It is certainly accurate that smaller apartment units and lower cost townhouses are going to be more profitable for developers. It's also accurate, and I touched base with a few developers about this, so I know it's true, that if developers are able to remove trees, they will certainly do so. But I think there are a couple of places where Joe's commentary maybe diverges from the facts. And one of those is that Seattle doesn't have unrestrained development. In fact, there are quite a few restrictions on developers, including on how they deal with trees. It's quite difficult in Seattle sometimes to remove trees, and oftentimes trees need to be replaced.
Unless it's the middle of the night.
Or have you dealt with a middle of the night tree thief, Bill?
I've heard. No, not me personally. No, go on.
It's also not immediately clear to me that single family homes are necessarily the best type of housing for people who are aging in place and people with disabilities. You know, most but not all aspects of denser neighborhoods can favor people who are aging in place, and people with disabilities are closer to amenities, they're closer to transit, they're closer to grocery stores, easier to get around. Simultaneously, a lot, but not all, of features of single-family home neighborhoods can be difficult for people who are aging in place and with disabilities. I'm thinking in my neighborhood of the sidewalks, right? The fact that homeowners need to maintain sidewalks and in single-family home neighborhoods means that around South Seattle, there are a lot of sidewalks that are basically just fields of blackberries and ivy, right? That's hard to navigate.
Mm. Okay. Others?
You know, the Joe's comments reflect sort of this existential concern, mostly by Seattle homeowners or people who have been in the town for more than a couple of decades, that all these lovely neighborhoods, and Seattle has lovely neighborhoods,
yeah,
all these lovely neighborhoods are going to get scraped away in favor of block-style apartment buildings. And I don't know, I don't think that that's true. And it's certainly what's being proposed right now in the city is not that. It's what's being proposed is pretty standard urban village scale development, which concentrates development around, you know, light rail centers or around bus stops, and doesn't actually mow down entire neighborhoods in favor of this. But we don't have much of a choice in this town. And I think that one of the problems we've had in Seattle is, and I would say this, anyone who's listening who is a homeowner probably is not in any position to sell the house and then try and stay in Seattle because it feels like the door is going to hit you mm-hmm. on the way out. Well, what this does is it inhibits your ability for mobility, whatever. You've already got a house, so you're actually in the lucky few. What it does, though, is it closes the door for people trying to buy that first house. And that's the real problem here. That lower end market has gone away because no one is leaving their house anymore to do this. And we could set aside, I brought up in the notes we were talking about earlier, you know, the problem with these investment companies buying up property, which are taking away from the pool of available homes to purchase. I mean, there's a lot of things affecting Seattle. Changing zoning is a big thing as far as the city's DNA, but there's a whole bunch of other problems associated with the lack of affordable housing in Seattle that isn't just about zoning.
Sandeep.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me say, let me put an exclamation point on what Catherine was making, which is that we have actually quite strong tree protections in Seattle. We just had a big debate last year about a tree ordinance, right, and a tree protection ordinance at the city council. And if anything, the folks that are sort of pro-density and pro-development would argue that those ordinances and those protections go too far and are actually sometimes a way of for kind of NIMBY type folks to stop development and stop necessary growth, right? And
yeah, but Joe's saying we got to stand up against that developer lobby that's going to try to weaken those protections.
Well, and I think that the comment was really interesting because for me as a political person who's sort of looking at sort of how politics in Seattle is evolving, this is an area, density and growth, that has seen an enormous shift in how people in Seattle think about those kinds of issues. And what you're seeing from Joe is, I think, what I would call a classic sort of old Seattle viewpoint. It used to be, right, in the old days, like lesser Seattle, you know, that we wanted to stay a kind of smaller, intimate, you know, I'll say kind of more provincial, but out of the way city. And we didn't want all that growth and density and to be like anybody else. We're off here in the Northwest. And
I can understand that.
I can understand that too.
I've lived here for decades. It's a lovely place.
I can understand that too. But that sentiment is a shrinking and losing sentiment in Seattle politics nowadays. The Seattle Chamber of Commerce just put out a poll. There's every 6 months they do a what they call the index of poll that shows that pro-growth and pro-density sentiment in Seattle has been skyrocketing upwards over the last 7, 8, 9 years. It's been a really significant shift in Seattle politics. It used to be, I'll say this too, it used to be the Seattle left was the anti-growth and lesser Seattle. And, you know, the old mm-hmm. Skip Berger from Crosscut mm-hmm. and the Seattle Weekly, his Mossback column was about how he wanted to kind of preserve
Seattle. That's a really good point because he was exactly that guy.
Right? And now it's 180 degrees opposite of that, right? It's the urbanist left that is saying the mayor's being too timid and weak on growth and we need much more density and much more housing.
Lefties and developers together. Okay, well then let me, since you brought up the idea that we don't, as Mike, you said, we don't have a choice. And Sandeep, you said, you know, that's that lesser Seattle thing is the old guard. Then there's the question, does it have to be that way, though? Why should we not have a choice? And this is, here's one more listener email from Paul. Paul says, I really didn't appreciate the snarky and dismissive response from the guest to the listener who described the benefits from single-family zoning. Let's start with a few facts, says Paul. Number one, Seattle's population density is already roughly 2 times higher than any other regional city. Number two, in the past 13 years, Seattle accommodated far more population growth than these regional cities. And number three, Seattle's infrastructure is built out at capacity in disrepair. It is not a given that increasing density will ease the housing crisis and lower housing prices. A lot depends on the level of demand, the income levels of people who want to live here, the level of housing supply in the region, and what developers want to build. Hopefully you can address this topic again with some more thoughtful panelists.
Gosh, no pressure, which is, though. Yeah.
Which explains this week's show.
I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint by being thoughtless about this.
Views of the folks, and they get demonized. I feel like there's a lot of demonization about, you know, separate from the affordable housing question, the idea that if someone who feels this way is they're racist, classist, greedy,
NIMBYs.
You know, and I don't know, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. There's a lot of different people from a lot of different points of view, but I think I feel a little alarmed about the us versus them demonization. But that doesn't necessarily refute your argument.
I think your listener and commenter, I think, has a point there that I don't think that any of the plans currently on the table for whatever level of growth, even if we go faster at adding housing, is going to significantly lower housing prices in Seattle. And we saw that Seattle Times put out a poll recently, wrote a story about it, some polling data that showed that most people in Washington State don't believe that, hey, we can just sort of grow our way out of our housing affordability problem. That said,
not by itself,
but we are a growing city, right? We were the fastest growing big city in America over the last decade in the 2010s. And the only way we're going to even maintain the status quo on housing, the only way we're not going to see housing continue to skyrocket in price is by adding more supply of housing.
Well, right? What I'd say is a fair analogy to this is when they did the massive reconstruction on Mercer in the Amazon Industrial Complex. And people blasted them for those years. Everyone remembers those years of awful traffic tie-ups down there, and blasted them for only improving the transit through there by something like 2 minutes, I think, if I remember correctly. But what they forget is that during that period of time, Amazon moved 40,000 people into that neighborhood. So just to hold serve, they had to rebuild that whole area. And weirdly enough, Seattle Department of Transportation deserved a lot more credit than they got in that, because that was in itself, if they had left it the same after Amazon built, you know, brought in 40,000 people. And my point being that this is the housing question. Like, you have to do that, has to be a component. Otherwise, you're not even going to hold serve anymore. You're just going to keep falling further behind.
I want to say that, you know, one sentiment that I heard in that listener comment is something that I empathize with very deeply, which is a feeling that maybe Seattle is pulling more than its weight, compared to regional cities. And I totally understand where that comes from. It's never nice to feel like we're the ones who are doing all the work and also getting all the blame. You know, I'm thinking about issues like homelessness, where Seattle has certainly been the leader regionally, and other cities have done substantially less than Seattle to move the needle.
Bellevue's a great example. I mean, the East Side Roundtable, they talk about all the time how that city is so reticent about allowing any level of density, that it wants to stay trapped in like 1957. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. I mean, because Seattle, absolutely, you're completely correct. Seattle absorbs a lot of that extra growth, or that at least that growth pressure.
Catherine, did you get to finish what you were going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, I think that's not necessarily, in my mind at least, and, you know, Paul, feel free to write back and tell me how horrible I am after saying this. But in my mind, at least, I don't think that's necessarily a reason to stop pushing for growth in Seattle. I just want to say that I do understand how difficult it can feel.
Okay.
Yeah. And just on the question of Seattle being it's already a very dense city. Let me just point out that, say, comparable city, San Francisco, has a density that is more than double that of Seattle. Right. So I don't think we're a particularly dense city right now compared to some of our peer cities. And I do think there's opportunities here for us to add housing and to grow, right, in a way that won't destroy the quality of life or kind of character of the city.
Okay.
How do we do? Are we going to face the panelist firing squad?
Well, I feel like we're still going to get.
I think Bill wants us to see this as an audition.
There will be a fresh barrage of complaints.
Exactly.
As always, next week. Actually, we got a couple of Republicans coming the next couple of weeks. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're not pro density, but we'll keep talking. We can have this discussion every single week about growth, and it's always interesting to me. I appreciate the listeners writing in. We will, in fact, we're going to return to the question of public radio opinion diversity in a few minutes on our show. And Sandeep, you're going to bring some anti-woke thunder, aren't you?
I'll try.
Okay,
I'll try.
Okay. Yeah. Stay tuned. Before we take a break, though, I want to get a politics update because this is KOW's Week in Review, by the way. Because on last week's show, the state Republican convention was just starting up, and the weekend turned out super interesting. The party made its endorsement in the governor campaign. They did not endorse the candidate who's ahead in the polls and in fundraising. That's former Congressman and King County Sheriff Dave Reichert. Nope, the state Republican Party endorsed former Richland school board member and self-described constitutional Christian conservative Semi Byrd.
The first black American ever endorsed by the Washington State Republican Party for the candidacy of governor in Washington state history. Please print that.
Okay. Party leadership tried to disqualify Byrd from the endorsement, saying it was because he admitted to the Seattle Times that he had committed bank larceny 30 years ago. When delegates heard Byrd was being disqualified, they shouted and booed and then overruled the party leadership. Dave Reichert was in town, but he decided to skip the convention, saying he doesn't need the party's endorsement. It's too fractured. And he's had more to say, too. Is the Republican Party splintering, and would that be good or bad for?
I'll jump in on this one. I'm not sure that it's necessarily splintering, but I am absolutely convinced, and Sandy probably knows this at a deeper level certainly than I do, that he didn't need the endorsement, and in fact, not getting the endorsement probably helps him a lot in terms of the moderates who he is trying to pull over, the people who are frustrated with Olympia from, let's just say, capital gains tax or carbon credits or anything like that. This is, I think, from a Reichert standpoint, is a boon. Like, he is absolutely going to pull those more conservative Democrats and a whole bunch of libertarians right into his camp. Now, whether or not that's a total numbers that are going to matter in terms of the election, I don't know. But I don't see this as a downside. Is it fracturing the party, to your question? Wow. I mean, I don't know. It's pretty fractured. Both parties, to some degree, are. So I don't know.
Yeah, I Mike, I got to disagree with you. I don't think it's helpful for Reichert that this happened. I mean, first of all, the convention itself was a chaotic mess. Bill, as you allude to, there was all this disagreement and the.
I didn't say chaotic, by the way.
Well,
I've heard that word, but they had a process. They overruled the party. Followed a process. It seemed
Jim Walsh, the MAGA Republican Party chair, complained that the word chaotic was being used, and I'm going to use it because it was chaotic, and he can complain all he wants, but the truth was it was a chaotic mess. And in fact, it reinforces, I think, the Republican Party's image as a hyper-polarized Trumpist clown car right now in a way that's not at all helpful for anybody running on the Republican banner, including, Dave Reichert or Jamie Herr Butler, the former congresswoman who is running for lands commissioner.
But the parties and certainly these organizations, this is where you pull in. This is not a representation of the party. You know this. Representation of the party as a whole. If you wanted to put out a magnet for all of the most polarizing people in a party, go to a convention.
No, totally. But there's no way for Reichert or Jamie Herr Butler to win unless the Republican Party – it's the prerequisite is they need a unified base of the party behind them. And then they can build outward. Then they have to build outward because we're a blue state, right? And to your point, they need to get independents and more conservative Democrats to come along too for them to have to win. But when they have a fragmented party where a huge chunk of the party now thinks they're rhinos, right, Republicans in name only, or is denouncing them, or sellout and traitors. It's very hard to see how you build a majority on such a fractured foundation.
Well, someone with that viewpoint would certainly find that convention chaotic.
Yeah.
Catherine, anything to add?
I was just thinking about Danny Westney's column on the convention that talked about some of the non-endorsement related news that came out of it, including that instructions for GOP candidates to no longer use the word democracy or democratic. We are now aiming to be a republic and supporting republicanism if we're in the Washington State GOP, as well as calling for an end to mail-in voting. Neither of those things strike me as particularly positive developments, but interested to hear your guys' thoughts. What do you think?
I thought actually bringing that up was a great idea. The mail-in voting thing is just, I don't know. It's so nakedly toward a particular point that it's almost like, I mean, I don't know. I'm not necessarily, you know, going to go full clown car, but I'm going to say that it is so brazen and so ridiculous that I don't know what you benefit by even putting that out there.
I noticed they didn't try to repeal the initiative process, which is direct democracy that benefits Republicans.
But it's just really self-destructive, right? Yeah. I mean, mail-in voting is really well established in Washington State. We've been using it. We went kind of full mail-in around 2007. It's been a long, you know, it works there. Our former Republican Secretary of State, Kim Wyman, was a huge advocate of mail-in voting. And so these are the sorts of kind of extreme, polarized, sort of, and Trumpy, right, positions that make it really, really difficult for Republicans to win races in a blue state like Washington. And that, even at a time when I think there is significant frustration with the status quo and with you know, the Democratic majorities potentially in Olympia and the exiting three-term Democratic governor, right? But they're not going to win if this is the kind of stuff that they're going to run on.
And Sandeep is not going to be afraid to criticize the Democratic Party when we come back from a break with viewpoint diversity in public radio. That is Sandeep Kaushik. We have Catherine Long from Business Insider. We have Mike Lewis with GeekWire. I'm Bill Radke, and we'll come right back with more of KUOW's Week in Review.
Support comes from Pacific Science Center, working to inspire the next generation of scientists and increase access to STEM education statewide through digital discovery workshops, science on wheels, and summer camps. More ways to support these efforts at pacsci.org. Support comes from Gather Pottery, hosting ceramicist Sarah Anderson teaching a weekend Sgraffito workshop for all levels, May 18th and 19th at Gather Pottery in Interbay. Learn more at gatherpottery.com.
You are with KUOW's Week in Review. Well done on that. I'm Bill Radke. You can watch the show if you want. We're on YouTube. Just search KUOW. And tell us how we look. And our panel, I'm going to introduce our panel again from Business Insider. Catherine Long is here. GeekWire's Mike Lewis. And from the Seattle Nice podcast, political affairs consultant Sandeep Kaushik. I'm Bill Radke. On this program, we work to bring you differing viewpoints. This region is generally liberal, and you hear that. But we also bring you guests from the Free Market Washington Policy Center, from the Chamber of Commerce. Nikki Haley's campaign chair was on the other day. Sarah Nelson from the City Council. I don't know that most people would call her a super liberal. We got a conservative talk show host coming up, and the former Republican Attorney General will be here, I think, next week. Still, many listeners do tell me that they agree with former NPR senior business editor Yuri Berliner, who wrote a column in the Free Press saying NPR has become too knee-jerk, too activist, and too scolding. A listener named Adam writes, "Until about 3 years ago, I listened to NPR religiously. I frequently gave. Now I feel that it's gone off the deep end. Too much of it is way too Orwellian. As someone who's center-left, I'm feeling repelled by the current trends and language gymnastics. Too much demonizing of people who aren't progressive enough. Please, I hope you'll give some credence to ideas of viewpoint diversity. You're just not trustworthy anymore," says Adam. Sandeep, are you one of those listeners saying hallelujah?
To that comment?
Yeah.
I think that comment is indicative of a real problem that NPR and public radio does have, right? I mean, just there was a New York Times story the other day about the crisis in NPR where they sort of frame it as NPR is like really rapidly shedding millions and millions of listeners over the last 4 or 5 years, right, that coincide with the the sort of the post George Floyd era.
And, as are a lot of media, though.
As are a lot
listeners.
Of media, but much more so than commercial radio. You know, the precipitous decline at NPR is worse than at other comparable institutions. And I would just suggest for anyone, don't only read that story and read the how NPR responds in that story, which seems to me very kind of clueless and tone deaf and in denial about the problem that they're facing. But read the reader comments on the story. New York Times readers, right? Liberally inclined, educated, thousands and thousands of people liking comments saying basically NPR has gone too far down what I would call a quote-unquote identitarian sort of centering to the exclusion of a very narrow set of views about race and identity and social justice in ways where those views are seen as sacrosanct, and there's not a willingness to acknowledge that those views are actually contested and quite narrowly held by a certain segment of sort of progressive opinion. Mm-hmm. But even sort of normie liberals, sort of people like me, traditional libs, like actually disagree with some of those ideas and principles. And there's no there's just a sense that anybody who doesn't agree with these views is some kind of reactionary, knuckle-dragging, you know, probably racist, you know, because that's where I think NPR's problem is a lot of their liberal listenership is not very happy or not very comfortable or not in agreement with the turn. And I don't think there's any question that there's been a turn in public radio and how they cover all these issues.
Anyone else?
So this is a tough one for me to pick apart and analyze, because I think I'd need a lot more information before I did. But I would say that it's a shame. I think that the Yuri Berliner piece is what brought this conversation to a fore, because it was kind of a poorly done piece. And it wasn't, yeah. it was so easy to pick apart just in terms of basic information. Like, it was a lousy bit of reporting that I would have hoped he would have edited had he been the editor on that piece.
It was ironically poor journalism. Doesn't necessarily mean he didn't have a larger point, but I agree.
Well,
with you.
And it doesn't mean certainly didn't have a larger effect, right?
Yeah,
which was why we're talking about it right now. I've always said that news organizations, anybody who's been in the media, Sandeep, when you were,
yeah.
Bill, I'm sure we've all had this from our family members about, you know, people who make the blanket criticisms of media vis-a-vis liberal or not so much conservative, but let's just add that in there. And I've always said, look, it's very easy to make a balanced story. It's very easy for me to go out and get opinions from a variety of sides, not just two sides, but a variety of sides. And I did that my whole career. I said the way you should judge a news organization for good or ill is what they choose to cover, not how they cover things. Because a decision to not cover something and a decision to cover something else is a much more profound decision in terms of a news organization. Like, mm-hmm. what you decide isn't news,
mm-hmm.
and what you decide is news is a much better way to. But I don't understand. So this NPR kerfluffle, while important, I think is not really addressing what I would say is the more interesting thing. I would love to see topically. If we're going to discuss it on NPR, but I'd go with New York Times, any big media organizations, topically, what these organizations have covered and how that has changed over the course of the last 10 or 15 years. And maybe then I would be able to make some more decisions about left-leaning. But I don't know that I would look at a lot of what NPR does and say left-leaning. A lot of it, the bulk of it is pretty straight-ahead journalism. I understand that these other things do happen, and the New York Times, these other things do happen, but honestly, I see some quality journalism there.
Yeah.
I mean, remember, on Fox, their polling people and their polling reporters were excellent. They were not a little bit good. They were some of the best in the business. You can find it in there. You can also find, you know, you can saddle up on your confirmation bias and find whatever you want, right?
Catherine? Yeah, I want to underline some of what Mike said. You know, it's not. I would also like more data before I come to any conclusions about the purported hard progressive bias of NPR. I also wonder whether we're putting the cart before the horse a little bit, right? I mean, there's been such a major change in people who consume media in the last 10 years, right? There's been such a major change in the electorate, in what people think of media, what people think of identity politics, how people are able to identify what they define as identity politics or identitarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, you know, is it the case that NPR changed drastically, or is it the case that its listeners changed drastically, and their perception of NPR's reporting has changed along with that. You know, trust in media is very low. We're increasingly seen as the enemy, and I wonder if some of those attitudes are filtering into perceptions of how NPR's reporting is or is not biased.
Look, I do think there have been changes at the audience level, and I for instance on the political right, like a lot of kind of conservative people have sort of decamped into their own sort of self-contained media ecosystem of, it's not just Fox News, but there's a whole, you know, world of conservative news where you can go and basically have your priors ratified. But I don't think that there's any credible argument that there hasn't been a significant shift in public radio about how certain issues are covered. Let me just throw out a couple of precepts or beliefs, right? Colorblindness, however unattainable, is a worthwhile goal to pursue in our society.
But that's not a neutral. That's not an. That is. But that is a viewpoint. It's that, not like that's it's, neutrality to
well,
have
well,
that.
Well, right. But that is a view. But my point, Bill, is that is a viewpoint that is held by 75%+ of Americans in the United States, not just people on the right, but many, many people on the left. You will find large majorities of people of color who yet we have public radio saying, oh, that's terrible and wrong.
Well, you know, is it the job of public radio to confirm people's priors?
I think it's the job of public radio to cover the controversy and not piously pick a side in it.
And
right?
I think that NPR has covered the controversy over that. I mean,
I think NPR's coverage and
can I point something out? Just to add, of this we've said. There is a big strain of it's gone too far. I mean, just in – I'm not picking on Adam. I don't know Adam. But he says it's Orwellian and says identifies as being center-left, and there's demonizing. So I do think, maybe to what Catherine was saying, I think there's a strain of it was okay when NPR was too liberal. And by the way, NPR is not revolutionary and Marxist. I've heard my whole career that they're too liberal and that they're too status quo, comfy conservative. It's small C conservative. But I think I do pick up a strain, and from emails I get from listeners, of it was okay when they were just liberal, but now I'm being made to be the bad guy because whether it's politics, maybe I'm getting older, maybe I'm white, maybe I'm a landowner, maybe nothing to do with those. But for whatever reason, I am center left, and I'm being made to feel guilty and wrong and the bad guy, and that will make any of your opinions extra juiced when you're angry like that. That's my sense. Yeah.
Because I'm not a white person, right? I really, this is something that actually kind of has pissed me off over the last few years. When I see public radio is a big offender in this regard, the only views that are sort of platformed on what racism is, how race works in America, are a set of views that most people of color in the United States don't subscribe to, right? And those voices are – so whatever about, you know, the white libs that don't like it. But I'm a center-left person of color, and why the hell are the kind of viewpoints about race that I know lots and lots of their black and Asian and
yes, I agree.
Subscribe to, why are they being ignored for the favor of these activist views that happen to align – duh – with the views of a certain sort of educated white progressive, right? And those things are getting amplified and platformed to the extent of the full range and diversity of viewpoints within communities of color, right? Yep. And I think that's where NPR and public radio would be better served in trying to kind of explore that debate.
Well, I mean, the program right before this was platforming a variety of views of people of color about a controversy that affects people of color. And
that's
I think
and I'm platforming you right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, and I appreciate that. And thank you. I mean, I'm probably canceled after this.
No,
but
not at all.
No one's being canceled.
Sandy, if you're not canceled by the tree lobby.
Sandy, don't mess this up for the rest of us.
I know. Between the tree people and the identitarians, we're, you know.
I'm just saying, I agree. I think I'm not saying there's nothing to what you're saying, Sandeep. I agree with a lot of it, right?
Yeah.
I just think what's being you can feel ignored. Something feels like your point of view is not is just being ignored. I think it's a little exaggerated, but I think it can feel that way if you hear over and over and a point of view that maybe you don't. That's not really your life experience, you know. And it puts you on the spot. And I just think both of those are both of those can be true.
Well, a super important point here because this gets sort of muddled a lot in this conversation, which is a fraught conversation, right? Because we're touching on really. Deeply held people's deeply held beliefs about really personal issues, right? And I have strong feelings because of my own experience of race in America about what works and what doesn't. But NPR's sort of defense of this is that we're just looking to create greater diversity, right, within our organization, and absolutely that's an incredibly important and valuable goal. Like I don't want to. Minimize the value of that mm-hmm. and that desire. It's the question is what NPR did or tried to do it, which, by the way, as the New York Times pointed out, isn't working pretty well for them because what they did was
Are you saying the NPR ought to be – the goal should be the most financial success possible?
I'm saying it should be the best journalism possible,
yes.
Right?
Okay.
Right. And what the shift is that the – just recent CEO of NPR, his announcement that the North Star of NPR was going to be this race and social justice agenda. It wasn't about great journalism. It was about pursuing certain like – that's okay. Where things start to go off the rails, I think.
When I really could say a lot more about that. Yeah, but we have a whole week of news to cover. Is there anything – Mike, I feel like I jumped over you. Yeah. And,
no, I mean I was going to add something, but we're rolling ahead. I did want to say one kind of funny aside that somewhat dovetails into this. So I do work on, obviously here, and I do work on Cairo Radio as well as a fill-in host there. Mm-hmm. And it's if it wasn't apparent that they have pretty different demographics, it's very apparent in who responds. Because if I am on this show or I am on NPR, all of my like professional white-collar friends, other journalists, but like, hey, I heard you on the show, blah, blah, blah. Maybe they liked it, maybe they didn't. And none of the people I also am for those who don't know, I'm also co-owner of a bar here in Seattle. When I'm on NPR, none of the delivery drivers say a thing. When I am on Cairo, none of my friends, none of my like the my journalism colleagues, generally speaking, haven't heard me on Cairo. But when I'm on Cairo, every delivery driver who comes to the bar has heard me. And this is an interesting – there's such a radical – just my small sample size, mm-hmm. but it has been consistent for years now. There is a radical shift in the demographics of the two places and who and at what income level – blue versus white collar, and that also factors in. You have what comes along with that is race as well and economic status, and it's very different how both are which groups both are reaching, and both are missing groups, and both are actually hitting groups fairly hard and consistently, but rarely outside of that. It feels like to me, and that's just anecdotally.
We really have got to talk about other things, Catherine. And
I'll just say what one thing quickly. One thing that this conversation has evinced to me is the disparity between how often people say that they want media to challenge them, to present them with new viewpoints, and then how in reality it seems like they would prefer that possibly it did that less often.
that is sometimes my sense. And I'm going to hear from listeners that who are going to say that I said that's always my sense. And that's just not true. I found much to agree with in what everybody said, and this is a good conversation. I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you having this conversation. I mean, I think that's healthy and good, right?
Well, for your last time on the show.
So yeah. And I'm just going to get canceled in Seattle. I will say contesting some of these views just outside, not even in terms of media, but just in the broader culture of Seattle is sometimes pretty fraught and pretty difficult.
Absolutely,
like there are some very strongly held views that if you deviate from, you get in trouble, which is why I think I've been reluctant to talk about this stuff in the past.
Oh, we can do this.
Yeah.
We can do this, Seattle. Okay, we got to take a break and come back on KOW's Week in Review because we have more week to review, so don't go away. This KOW's Week in Review. Listen to that laughter. Still friends. Civil dialogue with Sandeep Kaushik, public affairs consultant, Business Insider's Catherine Long, GeekWire's Mike Lewis, and I'm Bill Radke. We had good discussions to the point where we got to just whip through some stories in short form here and see what we can get to. East Side Light Rail opening tomorrow, Saturday. Number 2 line, the 2 line connecting South Bellevue to Redmond. Not with Seattle yet. I-90 connection across the lake is jacked up and won't be open until at least next year. Grizzly bears will be reintroduced to North Cascades National Park. KUOW environment reporter John Ryan told us up to 7 grizzlies a year will be airlifted in, which I'd like to watch.
Many rural residents living nearby have opposed the plan, citing the danger of bears attacking hikers or farmers. Wildlife officials say attacks are unlikely, especially if people learn how to avoid provoking the bears.
Catherine, you and I were talking about they're going to put trackers on these bears.
Yes, and what I would love to see is an app showing me where all the bears are so I can avoid them. Roll it out, Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Do it. I kind of wanted bear cams, like body cams, but I think that's not happening. High-capacity gun magazines will stay illegal for now in our state. The state Supreme Court keeping the ban in place while they review it. State appeals panel ruled downtown Seattle property owners owe the city $16 million for the new waterfront. The city taxed them, saying, well, you're going to benefit from the waterfront. And some property owners said that's arbitrary. And the pandemic has made downtown less valuable. Let's see. I wanted to hear a little, Catherine, about your story in Business Insider about the American Kennel Club's pedophile problem. Will you tell us what that's about?
Yeah, I looked into the American Kennel Club. For decades, people who have gone to dog shows and are involved in dog shows, which is a huge sport with tens of thousands of events nationwide each year, have been asking the American Kennel Club to enact stronger rules on whether people who have been convicted of certain crimes, like crimes against children, can continue to participate in the sport. The American Kennel Club has said basically we don't think that that's our role, and the upshot of that is that I identified a significant number of people who had been convicted of sexually abusing children and were then allowed to return to the sport. I profiled one case in Texas of a professional handler who abused his young teenage assistant over the course of several months, all at dog shows. He went to jail for 12 years, and when he came out, he returned to the sport of dog shows, and his victim encountered him at shows over and over again. She said she was terrified, and the American Kennel Club, which oversees the sport, did nothing about it. Now, the American Kennel Club is responding to this, there's been a lot of hubbub in the dog show world, and they say they're going to roll out some new rules that are more closely in line with what other organizations like 4-H, the Boy Scouts, the American Equestrian Association already has regulating child-adult interactions. So we'll see what that is like when they do it.
Yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for reporting on that. I want to mention the Federal Trade Commission is banning non-compete clauses. And these are agreements that an employee signs after you leave employment. You can't, is that right? You can't work for a competing
you
company.
You sign it on the way in frequently.
On the way in, yeah.
Not on the way out.
Not on the way out. No, no.
If they're trying to get you signed on the way out, you wouldn't sign this thing at all.
Right. You can't start a competing business a certain amount of time. So that's
competing
that's going
employer,
away.
You know, all kind. Yeah, they've been criticized for quite a long time it's not just the tech community. Tech community made it famous, but it's been out there. I mean, there were stories from the AG's office here in Washington State of stereo installation shops, you know, having non-compete clauses so that people literally couldn't get a job at the other stereo installation shop across town, which was ridiculous. And so finally, Washington State got out in front of this. I mean, the FTC, weirdly enough, is following Washington State's lead and saying no. And the nice thing about this particular – so a non-compete clause essentially limits your ability to get a job in the same industry. Some of them are very, very detailed. Some of them are not. This essentially – the FTC said, done. These are not – we're not going to – this is not something that's supportable anymore. It's great. A lot of companies – Microsoft famously moved away from them not that long ago. I think this is great. This is a nice thing about this issue is it doesn't really cross the, you know, liberal versus conservative. People who want job mobility are in favor of this. Companies – also benefit from this because they can now recruit much more heavily from other companies. This is great for wages. It's great for mobility. It's much better for employees. And it takes the power away from giant corporations to say, hey, not only can we control your work here, we can control your work elsewhere, which was always the sort of the ridiculous component of it. And
it's
I get it.
It's not unanimous, though. The Chamber of Commerce sued over it. They said it's stifling innovation.
Surprising coming from the Chamber of Commerce, I know.
Well, but I'm saying there are differing viewpoints.
Oh, no,
there are
differing viewpoints. But
they also said there's a bad precedent for government micromanaging business. Yeah, it's the chamber point of view.
Yeah, well, whatever. Right. I mean, the chamber knows knew that this was going to
You're
go
You're lumping
away.
Them in with the tree people again. Yeah.
And then the idea is to protect intellectual property, trade secrets.
Sure, which
thing,
is still all protected.
Yeah,
this doesn't take any of that away.
And Washington State already has a rule along these lines.
Absolutely. For mostly for higher income, because they were finding it going to like coffee shops.
Yeah.
They were doing non-compete. Like you couldn't go to the coffee shop across town, which was ridiculous. And so the Washington rule was 100,000 plus, right, Catherine?
Yeah.
I think that's
what
it was. And so I think this is great. I think the FTC, you know, and the FTC, you know, as an aside, kind of needed a win anyway, because the FTC has like pushed a lot of things that has not gone as well as I think the FTC would have liked.
This one was
a win.
We have a why am I talking? We have a Business Insider reporter here as well. Yeah, any comment, Catherine?
Oh, I went as soon as this rule was announced. I went to the Twitter feed of a source, an Amazon employee who was sued by the company when he went to go work for Google. Amazon said it violated his non-compete, and here's what he had to say about the FTC rule. He said, "I cannot be happier to see the FTC ruling to ban non-competes. What a fantastic day for employees! Employees equal people."
Mm. There you go.
Sundeep, you good?
No, I think it's great. Look, there was a good GeekWire story about this, and I thought one of the people that was being quoted, and it said, particularly in the tech industry, right, which is where with Amazon and stuff, we've seen these sort of non-compete stuff used aggressively. And the person who was being quoted was somebody who had been worked at Amazon and then moved to Google and got sued by Amazon for moving, and made the point at the end of the article, you know, it's great that this non-compete stuff is going away, but there's non-disclosure agreements, right? If it, you know, which is a better way to handle some of the issues around proprietary information or, hey, we have these sort of technological processes
exactly.
that you shouldn't take to the other company. Yeah, a non-disclosure agreement in that case makes sense, but non-compete, that's crazy, right?
Yeah.
And so this was a good move by the FTC.
Okay, listen, Seattle Public Schools dropping its highly capable cohort, which when I was a kid, they called accelerated learners or gifted and talented, superior learners, it was called in one school.
Favored.
I remember. What's that? Favored.
Yeah.
The chosen. So Seattle Schools is phasing this out in favor of keeping students together in the same classroom.
Yeah.
Right. So teachers would make individual learning plans for each student.
One quick thing. So we actually have a gifted student here in the studio with us, do we not? Catherine?
Oh my gosh, yes we do. Yes we do. Former gifted student calling in.
All right.
Two actually, but yeah.
Oh, you too?
Oh, yeah.
Am I it?
Oh. Wait a minute. Two. You want me to be honest? This sounds braggy.
Oh no, you two.
Three. Yes.
Wow.
Okay.
I guess I know who's not going
to
be on the show again.
The interview
see,
now.
See, this is NPR's real problem. It's too gifted.
Yeah, well, I do notice
I'm representing a common person here.
Yeah. Right. But the three highly capable cohort folks, white and Asian, which is an issue in schools, right? That's what these programs tend to be made up of, and the school system doesn't want to give extra advantages to those groups or segregate kids more, have higher, lower performing students together could benefit the kids, they say. Any reaction, comment? What should the listener know about that?
I am so in favor of this decision. I think it was a long time coming. I mean, the evidence that we have on gifted programs is that there is very little evidence. There's very little evidence that they do anything to boost the test scores of the children who are in them.
Mine did not help me. And I'm not being a faux self-deprecating. I was a crappy student going in and a crappy student going out. It's true. Trust me.
But, you know, I certainly do empathize with parents who obviously want the best possible educational opportunities for their kids. I think the data points us in the direction of saying that maybe gifted programs are not that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a terrible, I would say almost idiotic and certainly self-destructive decision on the part of the school district. I think we're already seeing a huge sort of flight of families and parents out of the district. I think in part because of, you know, some of these policies that have been pursued. I think that's just going to continue to happen. I mean, people, parents of means who can put their kids in private schools are going to continue to pull them out and do so. And that's bad for everyone. Every study on education shows that having a diversity of not just, you know, racial and ethnic diversity, but income diversity in classrooms leads to better learning experiences for all kids.
Well, they don't have to pull their kids out.
They don't have to, but they're going to, because even the Seattle Times story that announced this, right, was sort of had sets a scene in a classroom where the teacher's sort of spending all her time teaching the regular kids, and the supposedly gifted kids who are going to get the same level are just sort of off in a corner with an iPad, right, teaching themselves, right? No, parents, my kid is actually in the Seattle HCC program. He's going to graduate this year, so he's not going to be impacted by this. But if he was entering elementary school right now, we have the means, we would probably take our kid out and send him to a private school. And I think that's a real problem for the district that you know, they've already been extremely reluctant to probe why so many parents are taking their kids out of the district, because I think they're afraid of what they're going to hear.
Okay, we got a minute left. What if we hired far more teachers? Would that solve the problem of being able to have more individualized learning plans?
Sure. I think if you wanted to do this and say, look, we're going to put two teachers in each classroom, and so they can kind of because we have differentiated learning levels in the classroom, we're going to have two teachers who can kind of address that. Maybe that would work.
Okay.
This is just a way. It's a shortcut to equity, right? It's a way to let's lower standards and let's like take away the gifted program rather than doing the hard work of bringing up the other, you know, kids from poor and minority communities and getting them into the program and getting them these advantages. Let's just take it away for everyone. That is
okay.
That is a big mistake.
We're out of time to debate that. We want to give listeners something to smile about. Did anything make you smile this week?
Weirdly enough, I have one.
Weird.
Oh, I know. Gosh. Weirdly enough, because normally I don't. Normally on the smile thing, I'm just not in. Right. So,
so you don't smile much.
I haven't seen Mike smile in years.
I know.
He's a very dour dude.
We gotta go.
And I normally don't find my smile in Forbes, but I did this time. It turns out that we all know days are getting longer. That's when everyone gets a lot happier in Seattle, and I love the fact that it's, you know, sun rises earlier, sets later. Turns out the days overall are actually getting longer. Our rotation, Earth's rotation, is slowing by a few milliseconds a year.
I feel it.
And so by, you know, in I don't know, 300,000 or 400,000 years, we're going to have even longer days. And for me, that gives me something to smile
about. It doesn't help us now because we're almost out of time. What else made you smile?
Fat Ham at Seattle Rep. Saw it last week. Amazing.
Oh,
go
I'm
see it.
Definitely going to see Fat Ham
so good.
At the Rep. Thank you.
There was a free speech kerfuffle recently at Western Washington University that made me laugh out loud. And basically, some members of a racing team at Western Washington in a private Snapchat group posted a photo of a drawing of a penis on a pizza box. And they got reprimanded and disciplined for doing so, with the faculty advisor telling them, quote, this is a symbol of white male power and domination, and therefore, quote, unacceptable.
What made you smile about this, Sunday?
Yeah, really.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure when penises got coded as white.
Yeah.
That made me laugh. I was like, really? When did that happen? I missed that memo. Secondly, you know, I am of the view that sometimes a penis drawing is just a penis drawing and, like, doesn't have all of these big importance. But thirdly, I actually
wrap it
think,
up, yeah, brother. We're way over time.
Yeah. I'll leave it at that. I'll leave
that's
it.
It?
Yeah, that's what made me laugh.
Oh, okay.
I have a juvenile sense of humor.
Okay. All right, we have got to go. Thank you, Mike Lewis, GeekWire, Catherine Long, Business Insider, Seattle Nice Podcast, Sandeep Kaushik. Sandeep Kaushik, you political consultant, you. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you again next week.